listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, November 28th. I'm Fiona Martin from Drake University. Here's our first story. This first story is from Saturday, November 26th. It's called Bluffs Yard Waste Heads to Omaha by Nancy Garter. Those who treasure the City of Omaha's nutrient-rich compost will see a temporary increase in the availability of Oma Grow in another season or so. Council Bluffs will be bringing its yard waste to Omaha's composting facility for at least a year. The change was made after the company accepting Bluffs yard waste ceased doing so. The arrangement will add about 30% more yard waste to the city's composting operation, said Jim Tyler, Omaha's Assistant Public Works Director. Oma Grow is highly prized by gardeners, who typically snap up the city's periodic supply. Tyler said, Metro area residents likely will see the benefits of the Council Bluffs yard waste in a year or so. It takes about 9 to 12 months for the materials to be converted from yard waste into a usable end product, he said. Even with the extra raw material, the city probably will continue to run short of Oma Grow, he said. That's a change from years ago, when Omaha generated so much compost the city had trouble getting rid of it. We used to have to be creative to get rid of the materials brought in, Thayer said. Notably, the city sold Oma Grow in bulk use at construction sites. Tony Fiala, solid waste superintendent for Council Bluffs, said the Bluffs needed a place to take its yard waste after that city's composting contractor exercised its option to cease taking material. Council Bluffs picks up yard waste curbside from April through November, he said. The Omaha Council Bluffs interlocal agreement is good for a year and includes an optional one-year renewal. Omaha anticipates being paid about $42,640 per year from the Bluffs to process the yard waste. When Oma Grow is available, the city sells compost directly to the consumers for $2.50 per cubic yard bagged or $25 by the pickup load. It can be purchased at Omaha's composting operation at the Papillion Creek Wastewater Treatment Center, 15705 Harlem Lewis Road, south of Bellevue. It is also sold in local stores at prices set by retailers. The city currently is out of Oma Grow, according to website omagrow.com. Oma Grow is so popular that some residents were highly critical of the city's decision to change its yard waste policies. Beginning in 2021, the city switched from season-long curbside collection of yard waste to picking it up only 12 weeks out of the year. The collection is done in 2 6-week periods, first in the spring and then in the fall. The change was made to save money on Omaha's waste contract. Conditions permitting, Thayer said Omaha expects to collect about 6,500 tons of yard waste annually under the new contract with FCC Environmental Services. That's roughly 30% of what the city would collect during a normal year under the old contract, he said. The city is in the midst of its fall yard waste collection period. Curbside pickup will end December 2nd. Crews will work the following day, a Saturday, if they are running behind. People who have off-yard waste during the off-season, the time outside the 6-week collection periods, have several options, Thayer said. Bag and hold the waste until the next collection cycle, compost it at home, discard it in their garbage bin, take yard waste to the city's composting facility south of Bellevue, bag it in a designated yard waste bag, purchase a $2 sticker for the bag, and set the bag next to the trash bin. Thayer said he realizes that some people may think that bagged yard waste during the off-season is being taken to the city's composting facility. He said the city has tried to educate people that that's not the case. This article is titled Trucking Company Employees Laid Off Right After Thanksgiving by David Goblitz. It's also from Saturday, November 26th. Employees of a regional trucking company were stunned earlier this month when they learned they would soon lose their jobs after Thanksgiving. The employee of Mid-Continent Trucking received an email from the employer informing them that the company was shutting down and their last day of employment would be Saturday, November 26th. The email, sent shortly after 5:30 p.m. on November 16th, explains that Mid-Continent Trucking owners Brian and Ted Wickersham were selling their Denison-based company's equipment to another trucking company, Oklahoma City-based Western Flyers Express. Jessica Walker, who worked in the accounting department, said office staff were told October 12th that the company would shut down October 29th, but drivers were not immediately told. Days later, staff were told Mid-Continent Trucking would be sold instead with the expectation that employees would be retained. Walker said she was even offered a raise, but she kept looking for a new job. When I left on the 15th of November, we were still under the impression that Mid-Continent was still going to be open, just under new ownership, Walker said in an email to the Daily Nonpareil. The Mid-Continent email on November 16th also said that drivers would be contacted by WFX about potential employment. Other employees, like the mechanics at the company's maintenance facility in the Council Bluffs, received no such assurances. "Yeah, we're all out," said Tony Cruz, a mechanic at the maintenance facility. "They didn't need us. They got their own workforce." Driver Lee Massey, who provided the company email to the nonpareil, said he was contacted by a WFX recruiter the week after employees received the email, but he has no plans to sign on. He doesn't think any of his fellow Mid-Continent drivers will either. With Mid-Continent, drivers are used to being home every weekend, which is a rarity in the trucking industry, Massey said. Western Flyers Express, they have on their website that they expect their drivers to be out a minimum of 3 weeks at a time, and that you get one day off per week out, which is standardish for larger trucking companies, Massey said. It's one of those companies that you go to when you just start out driving through. Once you get experience, you don't put up with that. Massey said that rumors had been circulating among employees for about a month prior to the November 16th email that the company was going to be sold, but no one knew any details. Supposedly, they were going to buy us up and everything was going to stay the same, other than the bosses in business and status quo, Cruz said. But I guess, between the contract signing and the actual doing, they decided that they just wanted the trucks and trailers. When contacted by the nonpareil, the Brian Wickersham confirmed via email that Mid-Continent had agreed to sell its equipment to WFX. The deal is scheduled to close on Monday, November 28th. Wickersham also said that the decision to sell was economically motivated. "There's pressure to lower rates right now, and a small company like us can't survive in an environment like that," Wickersham wrote. "To try to make a go of it, we would have had to lay off people, ask some to move, and close a terminal down." Wickersham did not respond to a later question from the nonpareil about only giving employees 10 days' notice of their termination, which appears to be insufficient under an Iowa law requiring employees with 25 or more workers to provide at least 30 days' notice of a mass layoff to allow time for job searching and retraining. "We really are shocked," Massey said. "We didn't expect them to do something like this. Any other company, I wouldn't be surprised." Massey said that it's not uncommon for trucking companies to lay off drivers without any notice. "Trucking companies can be pretty hostile," Massey said. Massey previously worked for two trucking companies that gave employees literally no notice, he said. "You can show up at the yard and they say, 'Okay, you're done. Everybody, the company's out of business,'" he said. "It's being a common practice doesn't take away the disappointment Massey felt when he read the November 16th email. It's just, we expected more from Brian and Ted," Massey said. The Iowa Worker Adjustment and Retraining Act, signed into law by Governor Chester Colver in 2010, is modeled on the Federal WARN Act, but has lower thresholds triggering compliance. The federal version, enacted in 1988, requires employees with 100 or more workers to provide 60 days' notice of a mass layoff or that the company is closing. This next article is titled, "Putin Decrees Media Lies at Meeting with Soldiers' Mothers." It is also from Saturday, November 26th. It is by Alexander Sherbeck. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Friday lashed out at what he said were skewed media portrayals of Moscow's military campaign in Ukraine as he met with mothers of Russian soldiers fighting there. "Life is more difficult and diverse than what is shown on TV screens or even on the internet. There are many fakes, cheating, lies there," Putin says. The meeting in the Kremlin with more than a dozen women came as uncertainty persists over whether enlistment efforts may resume in the face of recent battlefield setbacks. Putin said he sometimes speaks with troops directly by telephone, according to a Kremlin transcript and photos of the meeting. "I've spoken to troops who surprised me with their mood, their attitude to the matter. They didn't expect these calls from me. The calls give me every reason to say that they are heroes," Putin said. Some soldiers' relatives have complained of not being invited to the meeting and directly criticized Putin's leadership as well as the recent partial mobilization that defense officials said resulted in 300,000 reservists being called up. Olga Tuskanova of the Council of Mothers and Wives, a movement formed by relatives of mobilized soldiers, said in a video message on the Telegram messaging app that authorities ignored queries and requests from her organization. "We are here in Moscow, ready to meet with you. We are waiting for your reply," she said, addressing Putin directly. "We have men in the Ministry of Defense, in the military prosecutor's office, powerful guys in the presidential administration, and mothers on the other side. Will you start a dialogue or will you hide?" she said in her message. Unconfirmed reports by some Russian media outlets suggest some of the women meeting with Putin on Friday were members of pro-Kremlin social movements, the ruling United Russia Party, or local officials backing Putin's government. Valentina Melnikova of the Union of Committees of Soldiers' Mothers, a Russian rights organization, told the independent Verska publication earlier this week that its members were not invited to the meeting. Since October, relatives of mobilized soldiers organized protests in over a dozen Russian regions, calling on the authorities to release their relatives from frontline duty and ensure they had appropriate food rations, shelter, and equipment. Reports by the Associated Press, independent Russian media, and activists suggest that many of the mobilized reservists are inexperienced, were told to procure basic items such as medical kits and flak jackets themselves, and did not receive proper training before deployment. Some were reported killed within days. Concerns persist in Russia about whether the Kremlin may renew its mobilization efforts, as Ukrainian forces continue to press a counteroffensive in the country's south and east. Moscow had suffered a string of battlefield setbacks, losing territory in the northeastern Kharkiv and southern Kherson regions. While Russian officials last month declared the partial mobilization complete, critics warned it could resume after military enlistment offices are freed up from processing conscripts from Russia's annual fall draft. There's an image in this article of about 20 women sitting at a large round table eating a meal together, and they have teacups and are speaking into microphones and conversing. This next article is on the front page of the Sunday, November 27th edition. It's called Dog Show. At the beginning, there's a picture of a man in a suit holding a brown poodle on a blue stand. There's clearly a show going on in the background. And the caption of the photo says, "Handlers show their canines during the Council Bluffs Kennel Club Dog Show at the Mid-America Center on Saturday, November 26th. Jack Onofrio, superintendent of the event, said that there were 790 dogs making up the 821 entries. There were 136 different breeds on display, and 347 dogs competed in the National Owner Handled Series. The Council Bluffs Police Department's canine unit was also on hand for a pair of demonstrations with some of the police service dogs and their handlers. Dog lovers are invited to check out the final day of the action, which runs from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sunday, adult tickets are $8, senior tickets cost $7, and kids 12 and under get in free." This article is also from Sunday, November 27th. It's titled, "The Heritage at Fox Run Residence Donates $40,000 to Associate Care Fund." It's by Tim Johnson. Sometimes the best Santas are the ones right in our midst. This was the case recently when a resident of the Heritage at Fox Run donated $40,000 to Heritage Communities Associate Care Fund, which helps associates facing financial hardship, according to press release from the senior living provider based in Omaha. The goodwill gesture demonstrates Heritage Communities' cherished culture of compassion, cultivated by dedicated associates and loving residents at each of its senior living campuses, Heritage officials say. "We're all in community together at Heritage, living out a legacy of love that defines the relationships between caregivers, residents, and their families," said Nate Underwood, president of Heritage Communities. "We'll do anything to help one another. This incredible gift exemplifies that." Since 2019, Heritage Communities has been assisting associates in need through its Associate Care Fund, which distributes grants as large as $2,000 to cover unexpected, life-disrupting expenses, the press release stated. "Anyone can donate to the fund, including residents, their families, Heritage business partners, and associates. Heritage had traditionally found informal ways to help associates in crisis, but it officially established the Associate Care Fund in response to the devastating impact of the 2019 floods in Nebraska. To date, the Associate Care Fund has provided $87,114 to 87 different Heritage Communities associates. An associate who lost her home in a fire had some of her immediate clothing and household needs met through the fund ahead of the artist insurance claims process," the press release stated. "One associate received support for funeral costs after the unexpected death of her mother. Another used fund assistance to pay for travel expenses while transporting a child for expert medical care. The fund has helped associates who have fallen behind on rent or needed to be removed from an unsafe living environment. Caregivers work so hard to meet the needs of our residents and ensuring their living better at Heritage Communities," said Underwood. "The Associate Care Fund is one way we can all give back and care for our caregivers." The donor at the Heritage at Fox Run in Council Bluffs requested to remain anonymous upon informing Executive Director of Don Ritter that the $40,000 gift was to be donated to the Associate Care Fund. The donation will enhance the assistance opportunities for all Heritage associates. "The donor wanted to contribute to our associate fund because they believe in Heritage's approach to senior living care, how we hire staff who lead to their heart and are committed to making a difference for residents," said Ritter. The donor said, "I want to support the Heritage cause, and I trust you'll put this gift to good use. We are tremendously grateful for the donor's generosity." This next article is called "Iowa Farmers Warn of Losses Over Mexican GMO Corn Ban." It's by Caleb McAuliffe, and it's also from Sunday, November 27th. It says, A proposed ban on genetically modified corn imports to Mexico would have substantial impacts on farmers if carried out, farm groups say. There's still uncertainty about the details of the policy, but stakeholders said a total ban on genetically modified corn, which makes up more than 90% of corn grow in the United States, would cause a drop in the price of corn and in farmers' profitability in the coming years. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador initiated the ban by presidential decree in 2020, with a scheduled start date of January 1, 2024. The decree stemmed from concerns about the health and safety of genetically modified products. Some Mexican officials have signaled the ban would only affect corn going into food, with exceptions made for corn designated for livestock feed, which makes up the vast majority of U.S. exports to the country. Obrador, who had previously said the ban will affect all corn imports, said he's looking at making an exception for livestock feed in a press conference this week, according to Bloomberg. If the ban covers all corn, agriculture experts said Iowa's farmers would take an economic hit and would likely see their balance sheets in the red. It's going to be extremely devastating if that was to happen, said Lance Lillibridge, chair of the Iowa Corn Growers Association and a corn farmer in Benton County. And it needs to be taken extremely seriously by everyone. According to an estimate from World Perspectives, the U.S. corn farming sector would experience a net $3.56 billion loss in the first year under the ban and $13.61 billion in losses over 10 years. Overall, the forecast found the United States would lose $73.89 billion in economic output, and GDP would drop by $30.55 billion over 10 years. It would be very, very disruptive, Lillibridge said. It would put us all in the red for sure. Brent Johnson, president of the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation, said it's not clear what the Mexican government will ultimately decide. That moving target is a huge concern right now, and we really don't have a good feel as to where President Obrador is going to land on that issue, he said. If the ban does allow for corn used for livestock feed, the impacts would not be as dramatic, he said. Mexico was the second largest recipient of U.S. corn in 2021, importing $4.7 billion worth of the crop. Iowa accounted for $3.3 billion in national corn exports in 2021, and Mexico was a leading recipient of Iowa corn, according to figures from the Iowa Economic Development Authority. There's a header called Senators Call for Trade Dispute. It says, Iowa's U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, both Republicans, said the decree violates the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the trade agreement between the North American countries, in a letter last week. The senators said that decree violates... The senators said the decree violates provisions in the USMCA that dictate that sanitary and phytosanitary measures taken by a country need to be based on relevant scientific principles and evidence. They called for U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai to request a dispute settlement under the agreement. Despite overturns to the Mexican government for nearly 2 years, there is little indication from the country's leadership that it will adhere to its commitments under USMCA, they wrote in the letter. The time has come for the Office of the United States Trade Representatives, USTR, to intervene on this issue. U.S. producers can't fill GMO gap. If Mexico goes through with a total ban on genetically modified corn imports, producers in the United States and other countries would not be able to meet the demand for non-GMO corn right away, said Chad Hart, a professor of economics at Iowa State University. Farmers are currently buying the seed they will plant next spring, which would grow the corn available for Mexico to purchase by the beginning of 2024. There isn't enough non-GMO seed to meet the potential demand, Hart said. It requires significant planning and also the right pricing and cost incentives to be put in place for that type of policy to work, he said. Hart said Mexico could incentivize the growth of non-GMO corn by paying a high premium and investing in U.S. production and shipping sectors for non-GMO corn, but there hasn't been much movement for Mexico to set up that production. Mexican officials have said they are looking into agreements with farmers in top corn-producing countries to source non-GMO corn, according to Reuters. Shifting to growing a significant portion of corn non-GMO would take years, Johnson said, based on the technology used to produce seeds. Storage and transport infrastructure for specifically non-GMO corn would also need to be expanded. So there's a really long line that is all interconnected, and it's not a matter of farmers saying, well, next year I'm going to make a different decision, he said. It is truly an impossibility. This next article is titled, The Biggest Giving Day of the Year. Giving Tuesday is November 29th. It's also from the Sunday edition of the newspaper. It has a picture of About 20 people standing at a table. There's some balloons. It looks like it's at a park. They're all clapping. Some of them are drinking drinks out of the same kind of cup. And the caption says, members of the CB ambassadors, local leaders, and members of area nonprofit organizations applaud during a kickoff party for the Share Iowa program at Iowa Western Community College on Tuesday, September 13th, 2022. Share Iowa is an initiative designed to connect Iowans to nonprofit organizations through charitable donations, in-kind gifts, and volunteerism. The article says, Giving Tuesday is November 29th. It is a global day of giving and the largest day of giving in our region. Giving Tuesday is a day that encourages people to do good and that every act of generosity matters. New to Giving Tuesday in Western Iowa this year is Share Iowa, an initiative of the Community Foundation for Western Iowa. Share Iowa is a one-stop platform for sowing good to nonprofits in nine counties through Western Iowa. Powered by the Community Foundation for Western Iowa, Share Iowa connects neighbors to easy ways of doing good through financial giving, in-kind donations of items, and volunteerism. Iowans now have more opportunities to yield positive outcomes in their communities and learn more about the organizations that impact people in the neighborhoods, towns, cities, and states. Currently, there are over 150 nonprofits partnered with Share Iowa. Nonprofit organizations partnered with Share Iowa or Share Omaha, the affiliate platform for the Omaha Metro, are dedicating time, efforts, and resources to Giving Tuesday to collectively advocate for support and connect with their community. Doing good makes you feel good, and giving back to the nonprofit organizations who are doing the work in our communities maximizes a natural and traditional season of giving, said Community Foundation for Western Iowa President and CEO Donna Dostal. For nonprofits to end the year on this high note of support and financial strength really matters. This year, the Community Foundation has a $250,000 pool of funds for a 20% match on gifts to endowment funds within the Community Foundation. The 20% match is on gifts up to $100,000 per fund, and after the pool is used, the match will go to 10%. Nonprofit organizations with an endowment fund with the Community Foundation can have supporters donate directly to their endowment fund through Share Iowa. Endowment funds are designed to continue giving to the nonprofit organization in perpetuity. They are an investment into an organization so it may continue its work for years to come. When the Community Foundation launched Share Iowa, it was important to include an easy option for donors to support organizations in a number of ways, including their endowments. If an organization has an endowment fund through the Community Foundation for Western Iowa, a donor will see a Donate to Endowment button on the organization's profile. The Community Foundation is also providing 10 $1,000 hourly prizes drawn at random for Share Iowa participating Giving Tuesday nonprofit organizations this year. We are grateful for the generosity of the businesses and individuals who sponsored these prizes, which are Castle & Associates, Frontier Savings Bank, Heartland Properties, Kid Glove, New Style, Sire, Slate Architecture, Kathy & Tony Talk, and Total Farm Solutions. Giving Tuesday 712 is sponsored by TS Bank. TS Bank's 43 Scott Street location in Council Bluffs will also be the heart for Giving Tuesday. Community members who are interested in making donations to their favorite causes are encouraged to come to TS Bank on Giving Tuesday if they would like to have a check presentation and celebrate the culture of giving in Western Iowa. Media is also welcome to attend, and different media outlets plan to stop in throughout the day. At the end of the day, everyone is encouraged to go to full-fledged brewery from 5 to 7 p.m. to celebrate the success and generosity of Giving Tuesday. We celebrate this day of giving and encourage the community, nonprofit organizations, and their supporters to celebrate with us, Dostal said. We are thrilled to show what our West Coast of Iowa can do when we come together and support the organizations that have a big impact in our communities. Giving Tuesday is an important day of giving. Every act of generosity matters, and everyone can contribute toward building a better world we all want to live in. Donors are encouraged to visit shareiowa.org and shareomaha.org to find new nonprofits to support on Giving Tuesday and any day throughout the year. This next article is titled Area Residents Urge Page County to Create Pipeline Ordinance by Kent Dinnebier. A pair of Southwest Iowa residents encouraged the Page County Board of Supervisors November 22nd to create an ordinance regulating, like proposed, development of a liquid carbon dioxide pipeline in the county. Jan Norris of Montgomery County and Marty Maher of Rural Imaging addressed the board during the public comments portion of its meeting Tuesday at the Page County Courthouse. Both residents voiced their opposition to the pipeline and urged the supervisors to proceed with adopting an ordinance to control the local development of the pipeline. Proposed by Summit Carbon Solutions, LLC, the liquid carbon dioxide pipeline would cross 30 counties in Iowa, as well as involving four other states. Carbon dioxide emissions from 34 ethanol plants in those five states would be captured and transported by the pipeline to Bismarck, North Dakota, where it would be stored. The pipeline would run through Page County near the border of Fremont County. Approximately 7 of the 685 miles of pipeline in Iowa would be located in Page County. Norris said the pipeline is proposed to be installed behind her home between two farms owned by Norris and her husband. The farms are located in southwest Montgomery County near Highway 59. Although Page County only has a few miles involved, every parcel counts if you are a landowner, Norris said. Other pipelines have shown that construction permanently damages the land. Landowners can never build a building or even plant a tree along the route. Communities cannot expand, fields are cut in half, timbers and habitats are forever removed, and our federal tax dollars will pay for it all. Maher agrees the construction of the pipeline would have a detrimental effect on the topsoil in Page County. He said the pipeline would run diagonally through his farm and would compact the soil. When you compact the soil platelets, it removes the ability of the soil to absorb water. With the machines they're using, they will compact the bejeebers out of it, Maher said. It won't grow anything. You're going to be, basically, a whole year without having any cover crop on that land. So it's detrimental to the soil and detrimental to the long-term use of that soil. Norris also thanked Page County for being one of 44 counties along the route of the pipeline who have filed an objection to the use of eminent domain by a for-profit company to acquire the land needed for the project. Earlier in November, Norris said Shelby County approved a pipeline ordinance. Norris said Shelby County enlisted the aid of a legal expert in drafting the ordinance. They fully anticipated being sued by Summit, knowing it was a matter of when, not if. So when they were served last week, it was no surprise. Norris said, "Gentlemen, you need a county ordinance to protect the citizens of our country." Of our county, Maher said. I'm going to read the obituaries from Saturday, November 26th next. The first one here is Flora B. Flo Ackerman. Flora B. Ackerman, age 94, of Council Bluffs, passed away November 24, 2022, at her home at Bethany Heights. Flo was born on February 19, 1928, on the family farm in Sherman Township, Montgomery County, Iowa, to the late Charles and Janice Pearson Cruz. She married Theodore Ackerman on November 23, 1947, in Sutton, Nebraska. They were blessed with four children, Connie, Sharon, Carl, and Judy. Flo was a homemaker and a member of Our Savior's Lutheran Church. In addition to her parents, Flo was preceded in death by her husband, Ted Ackerman, in 2005, grandson Timothy Owen, son-in-law Terry Owen, infant brother Robert Cruz, sister Dorothy Van Doren, brother Richard Cruz, and foster daughter-in-law Vicky Markey. Flo is survived by her children, Connie David Steinhorst of West Melbourne, Florida Sharon Owen, Carl Susan Ackerman of All Council Bluffs, Judy Gary Freeman of Wichita, Kansas, seven grandchildren, nine great-grandchildren, sister-in-law Margaret Cruz of Council Bluffs, foster son George Markey of Hershey, Nebraska, brother-in-law Reinhard Ackerman of Hastings, Nebraska, nieces and nephews. Visitation with the family Sunday 2 to 4 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service Monday 1 p.m. at the funeral home. Entombment Richwood Mausoleum with a lunch following at the Walnut Hill Reception Center, 1350 East Pierce Street. Memorial contributions are suggested to Our Savior Lutheran's Church. Next, I'm going to read the obituaries from Sunday, November 27th. This first one is for Marion Lewis Mann. Lois Mann, age 96, passed away peacefully at home November 22, 2022. A lifelong resident of Council Bluffs, she was born August 8, 1926, the eighth child of Pearl Moore and Elmore Moore. She was preceded in death by her husband of 72 years, Paul, infant daughter Tammy Sue, and infant son Craig Harold. Four brothers, Milo, Mike, H.B. Bernard, Lloyd, Leslie, and three sisters, Naomi Davis, Edith Roberts, and Evelyn Palmisano, also preceded her in death. Lois is survived by three children, Gregory of Overland Park, Kansas, Sherry of Claremont, Florida, and Ryan of Birmingham, Alabama. Two grandchildren, Jen Lee and Aaron Mann, four great-grandchildren, Leah Mann, Elena Mann, Gabriel Lee, and Sadie Lee, all of Overland Park, Kansas. Sister-in-law, Molly Moore, and many nieces, nephews, and cousins. Funeral service is at 11 a.m. Tuesday, November 29th, 2022, with visitation 1 hour prior at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home. Interment at Cedar Lawn Cemetery. Memorials may be made to St. Croix Hospice, Bright Focus Foundation, Macular Degeneration Research of American Cancer Society. The next obit is for Donna Marie Jones. Donna Marie Jones passed away October 15, 2022 at Clear House in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Donna was born in Pisgah, Iowa on December 30, 1928, the middle child of Anthony and Edith Martin. She grew up in Council Bluffs, Iowa, and graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School. There, she met her husband, Eugene Jones, and they were married on February 1, 1947, in Onawa, Iowa. Donna and Jean spent 63 years together until Jean's passing in July 2010. They loved traveling together, camping, and fishing in the western United States. Donna was employed at Peterson Radio as a frequency tester from 1962 to 1972. In 1975, Donna and Jean moved to Broken Arrow and made a home together there until their passing. Donna devoted her time to being a loving wife, mother, and grandmother. Donna was also an active member of TOPS for many years and even traveled across the U.S. attending conferences. She was a great bowler and a member of the 200 Bowling Club. She loved reading and always carried a book in her purse. Mrs. Jones was preceded in death by her parents, her sister Martha Carrier, her brother Levi Martin, her husband Eugene, and her daughter Kathy Hunter. She is survived by her grandchild, Melody Daly, her husband Robert Daly, and two great-grandsons, Xander and Jordan Daly. The memorial service will be held at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home in Council Bluffs, Iowa, Saturday, December 3rd, 2022 at 9 a.m. Interment will be in Magnolia Cemetery in Magnolia, Iowa, following the service. The next obit is for Nina Carlene Bertelsen. Nina Carlene Bertelsen, age 75, passed away on November 20th, 2022, after an arduous bout with cancer. She was born in Council Bluffs, Iowa on September 11, 1947, to Charles and Lucille Peters Stewart. Nina retired from Physicians Clinic in Council Bluffs in 2013. She was preceded in death by her parents, sister Kathy Knoll, and granddaughter Jenna Morton. Nina is survived by her husband of 39 years, Nathan Bertelsen, children Robert Daywalt, Diane Boren, Matthew Spruill, and Amanda Bowman. Grandchildren Stephen Scott Jessup, and Ryan Boren, great-grandchildren Samuel Olds, Jennifer Peasley, Abigail Morton, Jackson Morton, and Jane Jessup, great-grandchildren Layla Olds, other family and friends. Memorial visitation will be 2 to 4 p.m. on Saturday, December 3rd, 2022, at Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home. Interment at Rose Hill Cemetery at a later date. This next one is for Mary Lou Youngerman. Mary Lou Youngerman died peacefully on November 10th, 2022. She is survived by a son, Nathan Owens, two brothers, Robert and Tom, three nieces, Sarah, Megan, and Anna, and her closest and dearest friend, Shannon Wagner. Mary Lou is preceded in death by her mother, Elizabeth, and her father, Jack Raymond Youngerman. A short service to include a nurse honor guard will take place at 11 a.m. Monday, November 28, 2022, at Cutler O'Neill Funeral Home Interment in St. Joseph Cemetery. Mary Lou grew up in Council Bluffs, attending St. Francis Xavier grade in high school, graduating in 1962 before entering St. Catherine Nursing School in Omaha, Nebraska, graduating in 1966. She moved to Walnut Creek, California in 1973, where she spent the next 39 years before retiring to Longmont, Colorado in 2012. She loved to travel, read books, go to the theater, and party with her friends. She showered her nieces with gifts and love and would travel to Minnesota to celebrate personal milestones. She was thrilled when Megan moved to California and they could see each other more frequently. She thought of and loved Shannon and Chris Wagner's two boys as her own, Blake and Ashton Wagner. She was proud to see them grow into amazing young men. Mary Lou spent decades volunteering for San Francisco-based Family House, a home for families whose kids are facing cancer or other challenging medical diagnoses. She never missed a Family House event, and when she moved to Colorado, she often requested no gifts for birthdays and other holidays. A gift to Family House was a sign of love she most wanted from family and friends. To honor a life fully lived, please direct any memorials to Family House at familyhouseinc.org. The final obituary is for Twila Lee Heitrich. Twila Lee Heitrich, age 78, Honey Creek, Iowa, passed away November 24, 2022 at Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital. Twila was born June 11, 1944 in Burlington, Colorado, to the late Fletcher and Hilda Joannes Violet. On March 28, 1964, Twila married Jake Dale Heitrich, and to this union, three sons and one daughter were born. Twila is a member of Woodland Community Bible Church in Crescent and was an active member there. She is survived by her husband Jack, sons Patrick Heitrich, Honey Creek, Iowa, Timothy Heitrich, O'Fallon, Missouri, Christopher Heitrich, Minden, Iowa, daughter Sherry Bolton, Blair, Nebraska, eight grandchildren, seven great-grandchildren, sisters Ellen Morgan and Wanda Robinson, both of Andritzen, South Carolina, Jean Carter, Fort Collins, Colorado, many nieces, nephews, and family members. Visitation Monday, 10 to 11 a.m., followed by memorial service at 11 a.m., all at funeral home. Luncheon will follow at the Woodland Community Bible Church in Crescent. Memorials to the church preferred. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, November 28th, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Fiona Martin from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. That's 877-404-4747. Next, I'm going to read from the sports section from the newspaper Saturday, November 26th, 2022. The title of this article is U.S. Frustrates England with Tie. There's an image at the top of the page that's captioned England's John Stones, left, vies for the ball with Christian Pulisic of the United States during Friday's World Cup Group B match at Al Bayt Stadium in Alkor, Qatar. It has two men, they're about to head the ball, and they both look very intense. The article reads, Americans will have to beat Iran to advance. Loud cheers rang around the stadium. England's fans were not happy. The United States had frustrated them yet again at a World Cup. That's three times and counting that the teams have met on soccer's biggest stage, and England is still waiting for its first win against the Americans after a 0-0 draw on Friday. Despite the point earned with its second straight draw, the U.S. must defeat Iran, a 2-0 winner over Wales, in Group B's other match to advance to the round of 16. Coach Gareth Southgate had reminded his players of that record beforehand, with the U.S. famously winning 1-0 in 1950 and playing out a 1-1 draw in 2010. They didn't seem to heed his warning and didn't respond to Greg Berhalter's young and energetic team. England beat Iran 6-2 in its opening game in Qatar to justify its status as one of the tournament favorites, but it could consider itself fortunate not to have dropped another match to the U.S., after Christian Pulisic hit the crossbar with a first-half strike and Weston McKennie lifted a shot over from 8 yards out. I'd like to see goals, said Berhalter. We're proud, but our work is not done. Iran 2, Wales 0. Rosbe Chesney scored in the 8th minute of a stoppage time to break a scoreless stalemate, and Iran went on to defeat Wales. Chesney's strike from outside the box was just beyond the diving reach of Wales' backup goalkeeper, Danny Ward, who was pressed into duty when starter Wayne Hennessy was sent off with a red card in the 86th minute. Ramin Rezaian added a second goal moments later, and Iran widely celebrated while some of the Welsh players dropped in disbelief to the fields. Senegal 3, Qatar 1. The show is over already for the Qatar team, which was eliminated from the World Cup less than a week after it opened the tournament and launched the first version of the soccer's biggest event in the Middle East. Qatar lost to Senegal for its second straight defeat at the World Cup, and its exit was confirmed a few hours later, when the Netherlands and Ecuador drew 1-1 in the other Group A game. South Africa had been the only other home team to fail to make it out of the group stage in 2010, but it at least managed a win and a draw. Netherlands 1, Ecuador 1. Ecuador striker Enner Valencia scored a World Cup best third goal in draw against the Netherlands. Cody Gakpo fired the Dutch into a 6th-minute lead with a rising shot from the edge of the penalty area. It was the fastest goal scored so far in Qatar. Ecuador leveled in the 49th when Enner Valencia passed the ball into an empty net after a shot was parried. This next article is called Local Teams Kick Off the Season. It's from the sports page of the Sunday, November 27, 2022 paper. This is about college football. It has a picture at the top with Michigan and an Ohio State tackle going on. The caption reads, Michigan defensive back RJ Moten left and defensive back Jimon Green tackle Ohio State tight end G. Scott during the first half of Saturday's game in Columbus, Ohio. This article is called Michigan Stays in Playoff Chase. J.J. McCarthy threw 3 touchdown passes and ran for a score. Donovan Edwards busted the game open with 2 long fourth-quarter touchdown runs, and number 3 Michigan beat number 2 Ohio State 45-23 Saturday, taking down the Buckeyes with stunning ease for the second straight season. Playing almost the whole game without injured star running back Blake Corum, Michigan was still able to beat Ohio State in Columbus for the first time since 2000. The Wolverines advance to the Big Ten Championship next Saturday, with hopes for a second straight playoff appearance firmly in their control. As for the Buckeyes, they'll have to hope they can back in the CFP after again crumbling in their biggest game of the season. Jim Harbaugh and Michigan snapped in an 8-game losing streak against their fiercest rivals last year. Now they have a 2-game winning streak in the game for the first time in 22 years. Now I'm going to read from the lifestyle section from the Sunday, November 27th edition. This article is titled SWITG Sets the Mood for the Christmas Spirit with Nuncrackers, the Nonsense Christmas Musical. It has a couple pictures here of the musical. It looks like there's a bunch of nuns and monks dressed up and dancing in front of a green set with some stars in the background, a Christmas tree, some candy canes. In one of these pictures, a nun here is wearing some ballerina shoes. It's very festive. This article is by Heidi Hurtenson. As everyone starts to get into the Christmas spirit, the cast of the Southwest Iowa Theater Group production of Nuncrackers takes the stage Friday, December 2nd. As the fourth show in the Nonsense Musical series written by Dan Goggin, Nuncrackers, the Nonsense Christmas Musical, is full of humor and a great addition to the family's holiday season festivities. Running Friday, December 2nd through Sunday, December 4th, and Friday, December 9th through Sunday, December 11th at the Park Playhouse in Sportsman Park in Shenandoah, some show times are 7:30 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays and 5 p.m. on Sundays. Since this production is not a season ticket show, all tickets are $10. There are 7 shows in the Nonsense Musical series. Director Pam Lewis said in the show, the Reverend Mother, played by Jan Klopfel, has built a TV studio in the Mount St. Helens convent basement, where the nuns are recording their first show for television in front of a live audience. Money won by Sister Mary Paul, played by Megan Beery, through the publisher's clearinghouse sweepstakes, is used to build the studio. The live Christmas show features the nuns at Mount St. Helens Convent, Father Virgil, played by Michael Jones, and Mount St. Helens students. It is based on the Nutcracker, and Sister Leo, played by Angie Throwbridge, who is to be the Sugar Plum Fairy, injures her leg. While the other nuns attend to Sister Leo, Sister Mary Paul entertains the audience with a secret Santa drawing. In the end, the solution that Father Virgil and Reverend Mother come up with to ensure there is a Sugar Plum Fairy for the show is quite entertaining. With some audience interaction and loads of laughs, Lewis describes the show as a hodgepodge of little vignettes about silly things happening. One of those incidents is the Christmas presents being stolen from under the convent's Christmas tree. But were they stolen? No. But the nuns didn't know that right away. It turns out that Sister Mary Paul gave the gifts to a less fortunate family that lives behind the convent. Lewis said throughout the show, nothing goes right for the nuns as they try to tape the live Christmas show. Filled with traditional Christmas carols, she said, there are Christmas carol spoofs where the students change the words to the songs and are reprimanded. Having previously played the character of Sister Mary Paul in two of the other Nonsense series, Lewis said she has wanted to bring the fourth musical to the SWITG stage for some time. Initially wanting to play Sister Mary Paul again in the Nuncrackers, Lewis said instead of waiting for someone else to direct the show, she finally decided to direct it herself, saying, this is just as fun, just a lot more work. Lewis said it had been fun watching the cast develop their characters and seeing if they portrayed her vision for each one. Having to work rehearsals around several other shows in the area, at community theaters and high schools, she feels confident about opening night. The new cast on the SWITG stage in this production are Noah Feeks and Hattie Lyman as Mount St. Helens students. Additional cast members not already mentioned are Deanna Moses as Sister Robert Ann, Belinda DeBolt as Sister Hubert, Deb Martin as Sister Mary Wilhelm, Misty Whistle as Sister Julia, Gage Reed as Brother Brendan Joseph, Sophia Adkins as Sister Marie Celeste, Sue Hannah as Sister Mary Luke, and Alex Nordyke, Bella Nordyke, Reagan Baker, Allie Hansen, Bella Throwbridge, and Colby Smith as Mount St. Helens students. Chris Adkins, Blair DeBolt, Megan Calfee, Matthew Orton, and Tommy Hanna make up the Mount St. Helens chorus. Members of the live band are Reva Benfield, Cindy McCall, and Drew Morlock. Crew helping Lewis with the production are Lee Finup as assistant director / stage manager, Joe Gandy and Angie Trowbridge as choreographers, Tom Hanna as assistant stage manager, Pete Francis as lighting design, and Marge Schiralk, Leah Finup, Jane Klopfel, Sue Hanna, Kara Schiralk, John Henderson, Gene Adkins, and Don Jackson as set design. Come see the show, Lewis said. It's a laugh in a minute. To reserve seats for the Nuncrackers, the Nonsense Christmas Musical, email switg@switg.org or call the Park Playhouse box office at 712-246-1061. Next, I'm going to read the opinion section from the Sunday, November 27th, Nonpareil. The managing editor of this section is Rachel George. This first article is called Bono Yields to the Power of Capitalism. It has a caption that says, Rockstar's moment of surrender should reassure Americans about globalization. It's a beautiful day when one of the world's biggest rock stars talks about the benefits of capitalism. Global icon Bono is known for both his music and activism. He's the frontman for U2, which has sold tens of millions of albums. He's also been heavily involved in charitable causes, many of which are intended to help poorer nations escape grinding poverty. This experience over the years has led him to recognize that the sweetest thing you can do for others isn't charity. Last month, Bono did an interview with the New York Times Magazine. What he shared may give progressives vertigo, but perhaps they'll see the wisdom of it in a little while. "I ended up as an activist in a very different place from where I started," Bono told the magazine. "I thought that if we just redistributed resources, then we could solve every problem. I now know that's not true. Rather, the off-ramp out of extreme poverty is, commerce. It's entrepreneurial capitalism. I spent a lot of time in countries all over Africa, and they're like, we wouldn't mind a little more globalization, actually." Indeed, he's right. The United States and its free market-oriented economic system has created so much wealth for its citizens that many have gone numb to the system, capitalism, responsible for that abundance. Few can even articulate the reasons capitalism does such a masterful job of creating prosperity. To start, it allows people to keep the fruit of their labors. This incentive inspires people to work harder, producing more goods and services. William Bradford and the Pilgrims discovered this more than 400 years ago, but in today's busy and out-of-control world, it's a lesson that needs to be relearned continuously. Of course, there are excesses in any system, but the miracle of capitalism ensures the efficient allocation of resources, lifting up the greatest number of people in the process. Entrepreneurs make money by providing things that other people want. These mutually beneficial transactions leave both parties better off. Decentralized decision-making allows resources to be shifted more quickly into higher demand areas. Adam Smith described this coordination as the market's invisible hand. "Globalization has brought more people out of poverty than any other ism," Bono said. "If somebody comes to me with a better idea, I'll sign up. I didn't grow up to like the idea that we've made heroes out of business people, but if you're bringing jobs to a community and treating people well, then you are a hero." Breathe in that wisdom. With or without you, Bono has found what he's looking for, the best ways to help the world poor. This next article is called, "Is President Fatally Stubborn or Virtuously Tenacious?" November 20th was Joe Biden's 80th birthday. Our first octogenarian president is 2 years older than Ronald Reagan was when his presidency ended in 1989. Biden is still fit and energetic, but he's also showing his age. His hair is thinner, his gait stiffer, his speech a little more garbled than when he arrived in the White House almost 2 years ago. One thing hasn't changed, he's famously stubborn, and now that he's 80, it's probably fair to describe him as a stubborn old man. Ask anyone who's worked for Biden, and you'll hear a version of the same description. He listens to dissenting voices, but once he's made up his mind, he's almost unshakable. "One thing I learned quickly," a former aide told me, "you don't tell Joe Biden what to say. When he is wrong, that stubbornness may be his worst vice. When he's right, it may be his most useful virtue." Biden's stubbornness has helped steer his presidency into some of its deepest potholes. It produced the debacle of the U.S. withdrawal from Kabul when Biden dismissed pleas from the military for delay. Asked later if he thought he made mistakes in Afghanistan, he said no. It shook public confidence when he prematurely declared victory over the COVID-19 pandemic, even as federal experts warned that the disease was still spreading. This year, it drove his popularity down when he brushed off warnings of rising inflation and stuck to an economic message, "Things are better than you think," that seemed disconnected from voters' lives. But a form of his stubbornness is useful, a trait more often called persistence or tenacity. The president has that, too. His persistent support for Ukraine as it battles a Russian invasion has made him the undisputed leader of a reinvigorated North Atlantic Treaty Organization. This fall, Biden decided the most important issue in the midterm elections was democracy, the defense of the constitutional norms against the extremism of ultra-MAGA Republicans. Pundits and political strategists criticized the message, arguing that the election would be decided on economic issues, not abstractions about democracy. But when the returns came in, Biden turned out to be more right than wrong. An Associated Press poll found that democracy ranked a close second to inflation among voters' concerns. A surprisingly high percentage of voters unhappy about the economy voted for Democrats nonetheless, enabling them to retain control of the Senate and lose fewer seats than expected in the House. At a post-election news conference, the president was asked whether he saw any need to adjust his course based on the lessons of his first 2 years. "I'm not going to change," he said. Biden's midterm campaign theme, unsurprisingly, was an updated version of the message of his 2020 presidential campaign, a pitch for constitutional norms, a rejection of Donald Trump's extremism. And that campaign, candidate Biden won the Democratic nomination through sheer stubbornness too. He finished fourth in Iowa and a disastrous fifth in New Hampshire, but stuck with a strategy that relied on winning black voters in South Carolina and outlasting his rivals. Long before 2020, persistence in the face of adversity was the core of Biden's story. His national political career began in tragedy when his wife and daughter were killed in a traffic accident shortly before his swearing in as a senator. He endured two brain aneurysms. He lost his first two attempts to win the Democratic presidential nomination, badly, but came back for a third try. Now, at the beginning of another presidential campaign, Biden's stubbornness has resurfaced again. Will he run for re-election in 2024 at nearly 82? The president has said repeatedly he intends to run, and it turns out he meant it. People around him say the midterm results plus Trump's entry into the race merely confirmed a decision Biden had already made. Nothing makes him more defiant than critics saying he's lost his stuff. Nothing makes him more eager than another chance to defeat Trump. Asked whether polling that shows most voters didn't want him to run will affect his thinking, Biden said, "It doesn't." In a CNN exit poll on Election Day, 67% of voters said they did not want Biden to run again. But among Democratic voters, the ones who will decide on the party's nominee, 57% said they wanted Biden to run. 38% said they did not. That suggests the president starts the race as a clear favorite. As for his age, Biden said recently, "It's a legitimate thing to be concerned about. I think the best way to make the judgment is to watch me. Am I slowing up?" He said. "That's not how I feel." Is that stubbornness, the vice that can lead to disaster, or is it tenacity, the virtue that leads to hard-earned success? Don't ask Biden, he's not the best judge. All he knows is that stubbornness, okay, tenacity, has worked for him up to now. This article is called "Please Stop Highlighting the First Elected Whatever to Lead." Is it really news that Karen Bass will become the first female mayor of Los Angeles? In an era where women have already run Chicago, Phoenix, Fort Worth, Charlotte, San Francisco, Seattle, Washington, D.C., and Boston, the gender of the new Los Angeles mayor should not have dominated the headlines, as it did in numerous media. This obsession with the racial, gender, sexual identities of politicians has gotten truly old. That Hakeem Jeffries may become the first black person to lead a party in Congress seems unremarkable after another black person, Barack Obama, led the entire country. Bass's race did not make the headlines, mainly because she's not the first black mayor of Los Angeles. Otherwise, that too would have been right up there. Bass was a strong candidate, but what made her win truly remarkable was her opponent, businessman Rick Caruso, blew on his campaign a record $104 million. Bass spent only one-tenth as much. In a win for democracy, Catherine Cortez Masto put away an election-denying Trumper in the Nevada race for U.S. Senator. That her re-election saved the Democrats, their Senate majority was icing. I just wish that the press would stop referring to her as the only Latina in the Senate. Several Latino men are already there, in any case, beside the point. I wouldn't care if no U.S. senators were Latina, or if all 100 of them were. Fortunately, other Americans also seem reluctant to assess candidates based on last names or skin color or sexual identity or religion. Voters have no obligation to demonstrate ethnic solidarity in filling out their ballots. There are other considerations, for example, positions on the issues. Nonetheless, a BBC headline asked, "Will Latinos oust Catherine Cortez Masto, the first U.S. Latina senator?" The prize for identity madness goes to the New York Times for this 2020 headline. Torres and Jones win and will become first gay black members of Congress. Richie Torres just won re-election in his Bronx district. Mondaire Jones lost the primary in the redrawn district north of the city. Congress would need three black LGBTQ members to mirror the nation's demographics, the Times explained. This brings us to the unfortunate use of the word disproportional to reflect the idea that members of elected governing bodies should be chosen to reflect their identities, percentage of the population. Thus, a Boston Globe piece opined that the U.S. Senate is the least representative of America's racial diversity, with 83% of its members identifying as white, 3% as black, and 7% as Latino. It's unclear how one would count a Richie Torres, who is half black, half Latino, and complicated by the fact that Latinos come in all colors. Happily, I don't need to answer that, because to me, fairness means simply adding up the votes of whoever was running. This fetish with identity started as a tick of the left, which tends to believe that voters want candidates who represent certain groups, as opposed to certain ideas. What it should have learned by now is that Republicans are perfectly capable of running their own candidates of color. Witness their support in the Georgia Senate race of the unintelligible Herschel Walker, a black football player. Right after the election, CNN's Dana Bash asked Josh Shapiro whether he wanted to be the first Jewish president. Shapiro brushed off that annoying question. It was irrelevant because Shapiro had just been elected a governor of Pennsylvania, and annoying in that he was just vanquished an opponent who brought up his religion in a disparaging way. It seems clear that the public is well ahead of the media and not focusing on the candidate's DNA. May the headline writers catch on. This final article that I'm going to read is titled Private School Voucher Bill Likely to Reappear. A push to shift millions in taxpayer dollars from public schools to private school tuition assistance is likely to be back in the next legislative session, as advocates and opponents prepare to lobby legislators on the issue. Earlier this year, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds floated a $55 million proposal that would fund 10,000 private school scholarships using public school dollars, but the measure failed to pass. Advocates are hoping the measure will be expanded this year, as several Republican legislators who opposed the measures were voted out in primaries this year. Opponents and Democrats said they would continue fighting against any proposal that diverts public money to private schools. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, November 28th, 2022. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. That's 877-404-4747. I'm Fiona Martin from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.